bothered me very much. And that is, you're assuming that the economist you're talking about is trying to understand what's going on and not trying to promote a particular cause. The problem I always have is between the positive and the normative. I used to argue at one point very strongly that the differences of opinion among economists reflected primarily differences of opinion about what the consequences of a policy would be, and not differences in their basic objectives, and not sort of political bias, that I could treat them as objective, more or less objective, pretty objective scholars. But Rose has persuaded me that's absolutely false. Over time, I'm increasingly impressed that it is. That is, if you want to know what an individual economist's position will be on various kinds of policy, you will learn more by knowing what his political predilections are than any other way. Now here, let's take a very recent example. I recently saw Jim Tobin cited in favor of a minimum wage. For years, Jim was always pointing out the bad effects of minimum wage. What changes his economic analysis now? Now he says, oh, it won't make much difference. Has he truly done a quantitative analysis to suggest that the quantitative impact would be trivial? Anyway, you see the kind of thing I mean.
Yes, I think.
And that doesn't really fit into your pattern, Clint.
Well,
you did say there was a two-way relationship between the policy and the macroeconomic views.
Well, but I said there are these three elements in trying to understand how policy gets made, and I think they're all important. But most generally, when I think about individual maximizing behavior and I think about political activity, I think of people maximizing their stature, their position in a hierarchical society, and there are two arguments in the function. One is control over resources, and one is control over political power. Now, the trade-off, the budget line that individuals face when they choose a position of how to achieve this stature, the extent to which to compete for political control is supposed to control the resources, depends upon how society structures itself in terms of allocating decision-making through the political system or through free markets. And societies choose very different sorts of budget constraints. And one of the fascinating, if discouraging things about the Federal Reserve System is that it's one of the areas in the United States where we've not been able to develop due process restrictions, where there's an extraordinary amount of discretion. But it's a pathological case, but that makes it,
sure,
for our purposes,
mm-hmm,
that makes it very interesting.
Anyway.
And I'm sure, as you said, the Federal Reserve System, in its own terms, has been extraordinarily successful.
That's right.
Like the shark in the ocean has
absolutely
lived for a million years, and so we need to understand.
As I've always said, and as you've read me in my writings and my statements, there's no institution in the United States that has so high a standing in public regard and so low a rate of success in actual performance. Don't think you can name any other institution which has such a wide gap. But now,
yes,
let's go to Europe.
But I do feel, well, we can talk about that part of Burns later, about the particular environment that he lived in. But let's start with Mitchell, and perhaps I can learn something about the University of Chicago in the process. Mitchell was a student of Thorstein Veblen, along with Walter Stewart, who later was on the Council of,
sure,
Economic Advisors.
Yeah. And, Walter was at the Institute of Advanced Study.
Right.
He was in the business world before that.
Right.
And he has a nephew, or a grandnephew, by exactly the same Walter W. Stewart. Yeah, he won't do you any good.
Oh, okay.
I just watched has written extensively on the subject of fraud in science. He's not an economist.
He doesn't believe in the real bills factor.
He's not an economist.
He doesn't know what it is.
Okay. I just happened accidentally to come across that once, and I wrote to him and asked him if he was indeed related to Walter Stewart, and he wrote back and said he was a nephew, grandnephew or something.
Reading Veblen, it seems like Mitchell got two ideas from Veblen. We talk about institutionalists, but the better word seems to be sociologists. Whether you think of human activity as being built up from the self-interested maximizing behavior of individuals, or whether you see it coming from the top down, given the way the evolution of institutions shape the way individuals think. And Veblen was a sociologist in that sense. But it seems that Mitchell got his idea of the cultural evolution of institutions from Veblen. And for him, that's what made his economics dynamic.
Well, I don't know what to say. What you say, there's a great element of truth in it. He certainly was an institutionalist in that sense, there's no question. But he also thought of dynamism in terms of his business cycle analysis. You know, if you think of his book on business cycles in 1913,
right.
That really was not a static analysis by any manner of means. He thought he was talking about a very dynamic process.
Right.
And there's very little in that book, I think, as I recall, it's many years, but I think there's very little in that book that deals with this development of social, that you could call sociology.
Right. And the second? We'll come back to that a lot.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. And I'm just...
But there's no doubt about what you're saying. Let me go ahead. I first ran into Mitchell the year I spent at Columbia as a student. And I took Mitchell's course in, I think it was called something like History of Economic Theory or Economic Theory, whatever it was a famous course. And from my point of view, it was a terrible course. He spoke beautifully. Now, Mitchell had an incredible capacity to speak extemporaneously and fashion perfectly rounded sentences, one after another.
Right the same way. And so did Arthur, Burns.
Right. And, Mitchell was better verbally in that sense than Arthur.
He needed a pipe, too.
At any rate, let me go back. But I wanted to say, I had just come from Chicago. And to me, economic theory was economic analysis and engineering analysis. That wasn't what I got out of Mitchell's course. What I got out of Mitchell's course, and this fits in what you're saying, was how the circumstances of the time affected what the economists thought about and how they proceeded. So it was straight sociology along your line. On the other hand, I took a second course with Mitchell on business cycles, and that was a wholly different... I thought the first course was useless, but the second course on business cycles was very good because Mitchell really knew what he was talking about. He was heavily, deeply involved in that. He was full of statistics and data and ideas and previous theories. And that was very little sociology.
The other thing, it seems to me, that perhaps Mitchell got from Veblen was the way of dichotomizing the economy into an industrial economy, which concerned the production of real resources, how inputs are combined. And then superimposed over this a superstructure of business economy that dealt with the calculation of prices in nominal terms and the calculation of rates of return in nominal terms. And the problem with the economy, this is not a real business cycle view, was that as you just mentioned, it was in the faulty calculation of nominal values and their translation into real values, and that seems to come from Babylon.
Well, the difference between business and industry certainly came from Babylon, no question. But I'm not sure, I don't know whether Mitchell would have agreed with your description of his notion. And the reason I say that is because in his business cycle model, industry played a significant role in terms of what happened to investment in particular. Inventories, for example. Now, you can't really, inventories are part of the real industrial world. They're also part of the financial superstructure. But anyway, I don't know Mitchell in that sense well enough to say.
You know, we'll come back to all of these things in more detail. Mitchell also studied with John Dewey, the empiricist. And when Burns writes about Mitchell, Burns says that Mitchell said that you couldn't deduce individual behavior from principles, from first principles. You had to look at what they actually did. And that seems very reminiscent of the importance that they attach to actually going out and talking to businessmen and kind of getting into the mind of the businessman and you know, what is the psychology of the businessman, actually see what they did. I'm assuming that some of that from Dewey's...
It's hard to see any of that in the 1913 volume. Almost okay. Entirely statistical. Or take the Greenbacks volume, which on a theoretical level is not very good.
Mm-hmm.
Simon Newcomb's book on the financing of the Civil War is much better on a theoretical level than Mitchell. Mm-hmm. But Mitchell's is much fuller on a factual and statistical level. And I don't see it would now. He greatly emphasized in the Greenbacks the influence of the news about war events on the price of gold.
There were two things in the history of greenbacks. One was what seemed to be anti-quantity theory views. That is, he looked at the premium on gold
right. And
related that to the fortunes of the northern armies, and it didn't look like it was related to the quantity.
Yeah.
Although people certainly could have formed expectations. And the second thing, it seems to be there where he began to develop his ideas of the way profits changed over the cycle, that he looked at the way that the boom transferred income to the businessmen, increased their profits, caused that. So that seems to be where he began to work out his dynamic theory.
That part of it I don't remember enough.
Just to finish up this earlier part, then the final set of teachers were the sound money men. Laughlin, who was an advisor to McKinley, and took the opposite side from Bryan and Irving Fisher.
No doubt.
And
well, Laughlin was very much anti-quantity theory. There's in the American Economic Review, there's a great debate between Laughlin and Fisher. Sometime around 1903 or 5 or 6, somewhere around there, was Fisher on the pro-quantity theory and Laughlin on the anti-quantity theory.
And Adolph Miller was also one of his teachers at Chicago. And of course,
I don't think he was a teacher at Chicago. But Adolph Miller, maybe he was. I thought
yeah.
he was at California.
No.
At Berkeley.
Well, yes, he was at Chicago, and then Miller was responsible for bringing Mitchell to California.
Well, but then where was Miller?
He was originally at Chicago.
I see. And then he went to California?
That's right, and brought Mitchell with him.
I see.
But then, of course, Miller went to the board in the 20s and 30s,
yeah.
and Walter Stewart was there in the 20s, and they were primarily responsible for the Real Bill's annual report in
sure.
1924. Mitchell was not impressed by the work of the neoclassical economists, the marginal economists. When he looks at the behavior of price determination, he says he's trying to steer a crooked course between thinking about supply and demand, and actually trying to put himself into the mind of the businessman and think about his psychology.
So what in my opinion that comes down to is what I concluded after I took his course at Columbia. He just wasn't much of a theorist. That wasn't his mind. His mindset wasn't that of a theorist. In that, you see, he was altogether different from Arthur, whose mindset was really that of a theorist.
Okay, well, you know, just jump ahead without getting into it. You can see where, ultimately where I want to go is 1970, the breakdown of the Phillips curve. Prices don't fall during recession. And the question is whether Burns had enough of a theoretical model in his head that he could take that, the implications of that model to the data and reject the model, as opposed to tinkering with it and adapting with it. And it seems to me Mitchell didn't, and the question is going to be whether Burns...
I don't believe Burns ever believed in the Phillips curve, in the sense in which you're talking about it now, as a trade-off.
Right. He didn't... Well, again, this jumps ahead. He thought, at least he testified in Congress, that he could envisage microeconomic interventions in the economy, a jobs bank, various sorts of programs that would eliminate the standard Phillips curve.
Well, he could, like you and I, he obviously was very much aware that monetary changes could have short-term effects on your variables. But he was a quantity theorist in his analytical analysis, however he was in his policy behavior.
Well, okay, we'll talk more about that. But
well, let's go back.
I've tried to read as much as I can of everything Burns wrote, and you know, I've read everything he said in FOMC meetings. The only time he ever expressed a strong quantity theory view was when he was under attack for raising interest rates and he wanted a defense. He would say, sustained rates of change in the money supply will cause inflation. But he didn't operate in that long run. He operated period by period, and he didn't apply.
He said, and as I remembered in one of these hearings you're talking about, he said if money supply should exceed 6%, I think, per year, for any length of the time, you would have sustained inflation. Right. And the next year, under his control, it did exceed 6%. And the year after that, it did. So what I'm saying is that there was no connect between his theoretical analysis and his correct analysis on the one hand and his incorrect behavior, which is a mystery.
But it's less of a mystery if really when he came to macroeconomics, he used an analytical apparatus.
I don't believe that was at the source of it at all. I believe what was at the source of the disconnect was his greater confidence in himself as a politician than as an economist.
Okay, let's come back.
Yeah, we'll come back to that.
To that.
You want to go back to Mitchell.
Well,
Mitchell was a very, very interesting character, I may say. He was extremely able, had a tremendous ability to write and talk, and he had great tolerance. He was able to recognize ability in other people, and sort of, you know, I've always said the greatest vice of people who are in charge of either action agencies or research agencies or anything like that, or universities or departments, is there that great many of them are unable to appoint people to have as as colleagues or as inferiors, people who are abler than themselves. That was a great virtue of Ted Schultz as the chairman of the Economics Department. If he recognized ability and he was willing to bet on it, even though he himself was not as able as that fellow. It's true of his emphasis on George Stigler, for example, and on myself.
Well, it was a problem, this jumps ahead, but it was a problem that Burns got into. If you look at the people he
Burns
appointed,
never could do it.
Buer,
he had one of those.
Lilly, Partee, they were nobodies.
But I'll give you better evidence. When he was chairman of the CEO of the Council of Economic Advisors, he never tried to get me to be a council member. When he was leaving, he then tried to get me to be a council member.
Burns wanted to use his leverage over monetary policy to exert the maximum influence within government.
I
so it was very important to him not to have any individual who was contradicting him or creating dissent. It was important to him to be the Federal Reserve System. That gave him the maximum leverage to get the kinds of policies. I mean, basically, his problem was, this jumps ahead, he wanted to use a variety of microeconomic interventions to manage the economy, which meant that he wanted to not only be Fed chairman, he wanted to be Secretary of the Treasury, he wanted to be head of the Council of Economic Advisors, head of OMB. He had to sit at the table. And if you want to sit at the table, if you want to be a player, you got to bring something to the table. And he brought monetary policy to the table.
That's an interesting interpretation. I would never have put it that way, but I think you're right.
On this other point, though, I think it's particularly important in this period. I was lucky enough to talk to Ezra Solomon yesterday, and I asked him about Nixon, because Nixon was clearly a very capable guy, very
able. Yeah.
And Solomon gave a number of anecdotes. He
what was Solomon? Was he in the council when Nixon?
Yes, yeah, in 71, 72.
I see.
Yeah. He gave a number of examples where he would talk to Nixon about agricultural acreage set aside. And Nixon would be going through his mind. He said you could see the cost-benefit analysis and the trade-offs. So how did Nixon, how could a guy who was so able let the situation get so out of control? And his answer was that in Burma, the king, when he went to the temple, like everyone else, he had to take his shoes off, but the king had a slipper carrier. He was so important, he would take his slippers off and then have somebody just to carry his slippers. And he said Nixon's great problem was that he surrounded himself by slipper carriers. No one was willing to confront him and tell him and make him tell him how serious the problem was. And the people who got there were the people who told Nixon what he wanted to hear. And it's a problem of exercising power.
I wonder if that's it. See, the explanation I've always given for it is a sense of overconfidence in his own abilities, that he was sure he was going to be able to handle it. I'm thinking of the crucial crucial unwillingness of Nixon to burn the tapes. If he had burned the tapes, he never would have been impeached or resigned. And he could have burned it in good conscience. He could have said, I met with all these people in my office and gave them my word. This was confidential. I'm not going to let my word be spoiled by these tapes. I'm going to burn them. Do it publicly as a public act. Why didn't he do it? He wanted to preserve them for history, and he was sure he could handle them without having to do that.
Well, but I mean, can't you say the same thing of Arthur Burns and other Fed chairmen? Also, that is, Burns developed the leading, he was the first business economist, the person to use leading indicators to make short-term forecasts of the economy, to see where it was going over the next few months. And that ability to make short-term forecasts and change interest rates accordingly when things are going well, gives you a false sense of power. What you're really doing is tracking the economy's interest rate. You're mimicking the price system, but it gives you a sense that you're controlling.
True.
And then when you think that when you're under pressure, you think that, well, I can delay. I know I should be raising interest rates, but I've got these other political problems. I can keep things under control. I can make these trade-offs. You think you can, and you delude yourself.
Well, I may be. Anyway, let's go back to your agenda.
I mean, for Mitchell and here, I know we're going to differ, but I want to bring it up because I've read so many examples of the way Burns thought about intervention markets. But I mean, for Mitchell, I mean, what drove market behavior was not the way prices allocate resources by communicating information about scarcity. It was rather the psychology of the economic actors. And in the absence of value theory, what he was interested in was the institutional factors that caused lag price adjustment.
No, I think that's it. You're not going to put me in that.
But when you look at Burns, there's a lot of that too. For example, Burns's attitude toward intervention in the foreign exchange markets. He didn't think of the exchange rate as a price that was equilibrating trade flows and then had a nominal and a real component. He always thought of the short-term effects of the government intervention would have on the psychology of the markets. And
I have great difficulty with that one because I spent a lot of hours and hours one summer trying to persuade Arthur of the floating exchange rate. So during the period before Nixon came into office in 1968, when, as you know, Arthur was one of his main advisors, and Arthur organized a little group of which I was a member to advise him. And as you know, I wrote a memo on why we should have flexible exchange rates, which I gave to Nixon in the fall at the end of 98. And which Nixon made the great mistake of not following, although he... And the reason he didn't was because Arthur wasn't in favor of it. And if I had had Arthur on my side, I believe it would have been done, and it would have made a big change. And that summer, before that happened, I spent hours trying to persuade Arthur to be in favor of floating exchange rates. And I did not succeed. But I don't, and the problem is, at this stage, which is what, 68, almost 30 years later, I can't reproduce the arguments Arthur made on the other side. I had a similar, but I'm not sure your interpretation is right. Let me tell you why. I had a similar long argument with Lionel Robbins, and this time on paper by letters.
Right.
And those are available. And you and Lionel's, I do know what Lionel's argument was, because I got this up again a few years ago when I gave a talk down at Claremont in the Robbins Memorial Lecture. And Robbins' argument was not in terms of the short-run effects of manipulations of exchange rates. He was all against manipulations of exchange rates. He was all against government intervention in the market. His argument, and I think this was Arthur's as well, we have to nail our flag to the mast, was the way Lionel would say it. Because if we let go of that fixed exchange rate, our policy is going to be a will-o'-the-wisp. It's going to be a metastable equilibrium. Wherever we push it, it will go. There's no nominal anchor. And we've got to have this as a nominal anchor. And I believe that was Archer's view, too, but I can't guarantee it.
I actually don't think so. And I don't know as much about this yet as I should, but there are a number of letters from Arthur Burns to Nixon in the spring of 71 on this issue, And at the Camp David meeting on August 15th, Burns gave a very long, dramatic appeal not to close the gold
ring. And Nixon says in his memoirs, this is one of the few occasions on which he did not, and he always trusted Arthur, and this is one of the few occasions on which he neglected his advice, or went against his advice.
As nearly as I can tell, in many ways, Burns had the attitudes of the conventional businessman. And you look back to the experience of the 1930s, and like the prevailing wisdom at the time, he associated devaluation with the monetary manipulations of the Roosevelt administration. And he believed that if the Nixon administration were to devalue, it would raise that old bugaboo. And again, most of Burns's analysis then comes down to how is it going to affect the psychology of the investor? How is it going to affect the confidence of the businessman? And he thought that that would shatter the confidence of the businessman. And it was just sort of the conventional kind of argument against fixed exchange rate.
Do you have a record of what he said on that occasion, August 15th occasion?
I've only talked very briefly with Paul McCracken.
Have you read the...
The Sapphire Book is the name.
The Sapphire Book is one. But I think Nixon and his memoirs. Have you looked at the Nixon memoirs?
No.
I think we've got them here. And if you remind me, I'll dig them out for you. Because I believe he also discusses that. I also have read the Sapphire Book.
Well, Herb Stein was there too, and I'm not talking to him yet, so he will. He will know.
Herb is a funny conservative. He's one who never saw a tax he didn't like.
Yes. Well, I'm looking forward to.
He's a nice fellow. I like Herb.
Talking to him, but he makes me. He reminds me of Josephus, who wrote the. Jewish Antiquities and History of the Roman War. Josephus was a Jewish general who defected and joined the Romans. And then Josephus wrote a history of the wars.
I see.
And it's the history is self-serving. Anyways, there are a lot of memos, a lot of between Stein and Nixon. And Stein was a young guy, a young Turk, and he comes across as the guy who's really the one who's pushing Nixon to Nixon wants 4% unemployment by 1972. And Burns is the one, Stein is the one who's really saying, if you're going to get that, this is the GMP you're going to have, and with Open's Law, you're going to have this level of GMP, and to get that, you're going to have that money growth. And if you're going to get that money growth, you've got to take Arthur Burns on. You've got to confront him, and you've got to sit down with Arthur Burns, and you've got to say, Arthur, are you on board with this or not? Do you have these same objectives, or don't you? And are you going to give us that money growth, or are you not? And
Herb never argued against the money growth.
That by the summer of 1970, the council in general, and I think George Shultz too, had agreed that 6% M1 growth was a reasonable standard. And Stein is the one that was always pushing for higher money growth. He was the one that said at least.
But he's changed his position just precisely.
There are lots of
degrees.
Memos on
well, that. I once met with Nixon in the Oval Office during that period. I don't know whether it was in 70 or 71. Mm-hmm. Well, his purpose was to try to persuade me, must have been in 70 or early 70, try to persuade me to try to pressure Arthur to increase money growth. And I told Nixon, well, if you increase money growth that way, you're going to get inflation. And he said to me, well, we've got to win this election or something like that.
Yeah.
And I said to him, well, you know, I'm not sure the virtue of winning an election if after the election the circumstances are such that that the country is having a big inflation. And he said to me, well, let's wait and see about that after the election.
There's a good...
There's no doubt in my mind that he was willing to do anything that would get him elected.
Well, he was very...
Almost.
Very explicit, saying that no election is ever turned on the rate of inflation. It's always turned on unemployment.
That's right.
And
it was Arthur who taught him that. When was it? 1960.
Right.
Nixon versus Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
Arthur persuaded Nixon that what had defeated him was the recession they were having at the time.
Yeah, that comes out. All your letters are preserved, by the way. And I have a lot of them, and I'm sure I'll get
my letters.
The letters you sent, some letters to Nixon, some letters to Stein, some letters to George Shultz. Most of them are still available.
Maybe, but this one.
This
I
was
don't,
a, you
I
sent
don't,
a letter and you sent a couple letters that could have been the one you're talking about. One in early 71, one in early 72.
This wasn't a letter.
Right, but I'm saying you sent letters saying that inflation
that might
is
be,
going to
but the,
there would be a resurgence of inflation.
The event of the incident I'm
right,
talking about
right.
was a face-to-face meeting. It wasn't letters. I didn't realize I had sent that letter to him, to tell you the truth. But
well,
Nixon,
there are some,
to
there
the terms
are some.
Of IQ, yeah. The only major political figure I've ever met whom I would put on the same level as Nixon was Bob Taft, Sr.
Hmm.
Nixon was absolutely first-rate intellectual. Somebody else you ought to talk to if you want to get on this line is Alan Wallace.
I knew he was involved in the early...
That's right. When
Nixon, but I didn't
as
know whether
vice president...
After the transition and the initial policy of, the gradualism policy, I didn't know that he was involved after that, so I haven't...
No, I'm talking about an earlier involvement. This was in the 1950s, in the Eisenhower regime. Nixon headed a committee on growth or something.
Mm-hmm.
And Alan Wallace really was the executive director there. And he worked very closely with Nixon. That's how I first met Nixon. Alan had me meet Nixon in Washington when Nixon was vice president.
Hmm.
That's what I thought Alan Wallace would be interesting on.
Okay, that would be good. Burns said this of Nixon, so maybe he was serious. I didn't know how to take this, but he said, what I encountered, to my surprise, was a fellow intellectual. Dick Nixon leads a solitary life of the mind. It's extraordinary that he's been so unpopular over the years with intellectuals. He's really one of us.
He's right.
So he was
absolutely.
Serious.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, Arthur?
Yeah, Arthur Burns.
Oh, well, certainly. I would confer, I would agree to every word of that. I've always said Nixon was really an intellectual. He liked abstract ideas. That's the impression I got of him the first time I met. He was perfectly willing to talk in general terms about abstract problems.
Certainly wasn't like President Johnson, for example.
Oh, it wasn't the same. The only other political figure I've met whom I would put in the same class is Bob Taft.
Part of Nixon's problem also seems to have been a personal insecurity. That is, when Connally joined the administration as Secretary of the Treasury, Nixon looked at Connally, and Connally had everything that Nixon didn't have, charisma. And when Connally told him how to take advantage of the... I don't think you can understand this period, Nixon or Burns, without understanding what a difficult period it was for the United States. It was in a way like the Depression or like the 1890s. People felt threatened by forces that seemed beyond their control. And one of them was very much homemade, and that was inflation. And the businessmen felt that they needed government They wanted government to help them deal with the militancy of labor, and they were willing to put up with government regulation, intrusive government bureaucrats to deal with that. And the consumer wanted protection from greedy corporations. Detroit wanted protection from the Japanese that were sending in automobiles. The middle class wanted protection from the hippies who were threatening their values, the civil rights. And Connally was the one who could tell Nixon that you can put together a political platform, a coalition that builds on those grievances, that creates scapegoats.
I don't accept your interpretation.
Okay, that's good, because I want to talk, because I think this is important in terms of understanding Burns, too. So we'll come back to this.
I don't agree with that interpretation.
Okay.
I do, partly.
Okay.
But I believe you've got things upside down. The price control was put in order to enable them to close the gold window, not the other way around. See, by 19... Let me exercise this hypothetical thing. Suppose Nixon had followed my advice and closed the gold window in early 1969.
Mm-hmm.
I urged him, it was the first act of his administration.
Yeah, he could have done it then.
It should be to close the gold window and announce publicly that if you hadn't realized how bad the situation was until you came into office, you could blame the Democrats on you. See, when I came into office,
mm-hmm.
I found that our foreign financial affairs were a mess. The Democrats had followed a policy which had led to a big balance of payments deficit and a demand on our gold. And the only thing we can do is to close the gold window. Blame it on the... You never would have had price control.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that...
And the reason you wouldn't have had price control is because you never would have been face-to-face with an absolute deadline necessity. The real crisis of August 1971 was a demand for gold.
Well, okay, let me pursue that. It's clear that that's what precipitated the controls. And it's also clear that Connally thought that the way to package devaluation, closing the gold windows, was with control. So it took an offensive... It was packaged as the United States standing up to unfair foreign competition.
If he had just closed the gold window and done nothing else, every headline would have been that negative Nixon. He's taking us off the gold standard.
Right.
As it was, this is part of a big package. It's a great...
The import surcharge.
Absolutely.
You know, this is our club. And to finally get a fair sharing of the defense burden,
it was a Buchanan,
fair trading...
Buchanan approach.
Sure. But I think that was primarily...
Look, inflation was already coming down. It was less than 4% by the time you did it. In August 15th, it was about 3.5%.
Right. But what Burns and the Nixon Council were looking at was wage inflation. They thought that's what was driving inflation.
That's true.
And wage inflation was still at 7%. It had yet to come down.
And you're right about the businessmen thought that was a way to hit the union. But they would not have been abided by it if it hadn't been for one, that something else had to be done about the devaluation, and two, that Burns had warmed them up.
Come back to that, but I mean, I think there were three more fundamental reasons for the controls, and that the problem with the I'll quit whenever you...
No, that's all right.
The problem with the gold window, or with the gold losses, was precipitating. In the FOMC minutes, there's a discussion at the first FOMC meeting after Camp David, and Burns is giving a brief review of the rationale for the controls. And what he says is that in the spring of 1971, this is not exactly his words, but basically this is what he says. The administration got the monetary policy it wanted. It got very high rates expansion of M1. And what happened was that the unemployment rate was still very slow to change. The financial markets were becoming very nervous. Bond rates were going up. And Burns said that he argued convincingly that if I simply give you the expansionary monetary policy you want, it won't work because of inflationary expectations. You've got to combine it with controls. So That was one thing. The other thing was that they only had a year to go, and the unemployment rate was still 6%. They wanted a dramatic decline in the unemployment rate, much greater than anything they'd ever seen within a year. And they felt like to get the kind of expansionary monetary policy they wanted, to get 5.5%, 5% unemployment, 4.5%, they needed the controls. And the last thing is that Nixon was a master politician. He waited until there was just this deafening chorus of "Do something."
Oh, of course.
We have this problem. You're doing nothing. You're just sitting there. You've got no strategy. You've got no plan. So when he put the controls in, this wasn't an obvious program to reelect Richard Nixon. It was a response to this overwhelming clamor to do something. So politically, it was
oh,
brilliant.
No doubt. Politically, it was brilliant. Absolutely.
Although it was brilliant in the same sense as the dictator who stands in his balcony with the crowds cheering
right.
him.
That's
exactly
right.
The same sort of the strong.
I just got to interrupt for a moment. I got to go to the bathroom.
Okay.
Would you like to use the bathroom too? Because there's one down here too.
Sure.
There's one at the end of the hall and turn to the left.
Okay.
Is that if you get the average unemployment rate from 1900 to 1930, it's lower than in the 30 years after the passage of the Full Employment Act. So you achieve prestige because persuading the public that you can reduce unemployment and by following policies which lead to higher unemployment. At least if you just look at these facts.
On this other issue, though, of leadership, there are a lot of letters from Burns to Nixon exhorting Nixon to show leadership. Burns is saying the country is in a crisis, people need leadership, they're confused. And you get the feeling that Burns thought that Nixon really needed him. He needed him as a counselor.
That.
He, Nixon, of course, with good reason, didn't trust Connally. He didn't trust Haldeman and Ehrlichman. He thought Burns needed him as a counselor, and he thought the country needed leadership. I think that's one reason why Burns
felt
like... Look
at the number of Connally references.
He needed to be close to the administration. Although it's... Burns was very aggressive in trying to influence policy. When he felt like he was not being listened to, he had no compunction about going before congressional committees, talking to the newspapers, saying things that were very embarrassing politically.
Well, but it's very interesting from that point of view that when he was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, and the council was in a very, very low state in public opinion, one of the measures Arthur took to raise the prestige of the council was to refuse to participate in radio and talk shows or to make any public statements at all or to testify before Congress. Just the opposite of the behavior later on.
But that's because he thought that he was being listened to.
Here, this is about the strongest opposition, that's the freeze, not the price controls.
Mm-hmm.
Came from Arthur Burns. He wanted us to wait. Even if all the arguments were right, he said he still felt there was no rush and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So, he always gave great weight to Burns' opinion because of my respect for his superior intellect and because he always followed the practice he once described to me of telling the president what he needs to hear, not just what he wants to hear.
Well, maybe
this
he was the only one.
This
who did
was
that.
To be one of the
Possible.
Few cases in which I did not follow his recommendations. I decided to close the gold window and let the dollar float. As events unfolded, this decision turned out to be the best thing that came out of the whole economic program I announced on August 15, 1971. Isn't that wonderful? Whereas he says about price and wage control somewhere, that it's the worst thing he ever did.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He's very self-critical about them, if I remember the memoirs. Okay, now you go back.
Yeah, that's one area where I'm, I don't have enough memos yet. I was hoping George Shultz would open his memos to the public, but he's not willing to do that yet.
He's not, yeah.
Because I don't understand, I don't, it's clear that Nixon didn't like the idea of controls because he associated it with government interference.
Because he had been, the reason was because he had worked for the OPA.
Yeah, so he must have worked for Goldwater.
That's right.
On the other hand, the discussions I have seen of quadriad meetings, they don't emphasize that. What they emphasize is that the problem, the political problems it would cause them with the labor unions. And so I don't know whether what was going on in Nixon's mind was more this political calculation or whether it was more his own feelings of personal feelings. I just don't have enough information. But it's clear that when, at those times when the administration wants a more expansionary monetary policy from the Federal Reserve System, when Burns feels that he has more leverage, those are the times he goes public with his exhortations, not for controls, but for incomes policy.
Mm-hmm.
He feels like...
Well, the first time he did that was in the spring of 1971.
1970.
I think 71.
No.
Maybe you're right, but I thought it was 71.
In May of... I know this, and I'll tell you why in a minute. In May of 1970, there was a bankers' convention at Hot Springs, Arkansas, and Burns used that occasion to argue for an incomes policy. And that's the event that triggered your letters. And those are in in the Burns files in Ann Arbor.
I didn't realize my letters were in there.
They are, and I have them. You wrote one from Dorchester, and then you wrote one from Vermont. And one's dated, I don't know, maybe.
No, I wrote one from, Dorchester Avenue, right.
Right, yeah.
From Chicago. That was a
right,
hand.
That was the first
one.
They were both handwritten.
Both handwritten,
yeah. So that dates... the first one, and that's when the Nixon administration wanted to push the Fed kind of strongly off its concentration on bringing inflation down. And then the second case is in late 1970, when the administration decides it has to have 1065 GNP to get the unemployment rate down, and then Burns gives a speech at Pepperdine College and kind of basically challenges the Nixon administration. And there's this exchange where Stein says, well, philosophically I'm against controls, but, if that's what it takes to get an expansionary monetary policy, I think we ought to talk down and see if we can do business with Arthur.
God, it's incredible to me that Herb Stein could have taken that position. He did.
He did. He was the young Turk, and he was the guy who was rising up. I mean, you can see what's going on here, because he's the one with the competence. He's the guy with the answers. And for a young kid, I mean, he has all of a sudden just an enormous amount of stature in this administration. And there's a wonderful letter that you wrote, and I wish I could remember the exact words, but this was after the 1972 economic report of the president came out, and you start out by saying, Dear Herb, you have given the best and most convincing explanation that could possibly be given for a policy that has no shred whatsoever of any possibility of ever being supported by rational economic analysis. So you can see your mind kind of starting out with thinking, well, I should say something positive, but then you can see the way the sentence evolved by the time you got to the end of it. That's a great letter. Let me ask you about the book that Burns wrote in 57, Prosperity and Depression. I'll get the name here in a minute. I've got it down. It starts out with Prosperity. He lists you and George Stigler in the introduction. You read this book, And you get the sense that Burns thought that he had solved the problem of the down part of the business cycle, that he had come on in 1953 as Eisenhower's advisor. He's very proud of that. He never misses a chance to tell his anecdote about how Eisenhower tells him, Arthur, you would have made a great chief of staff. So you read that, you very much get the feeling that Burns thinks that that if government intervenes aggressively when the signs of recession appear, that you can deal with recessions, you can solve this bane of humanity. Then the remaining problem then is how to reconcile prosperity and inflation. That if the government maintains prosperity, what do you do about inflation? And you get the feeling, there's a feeling that this is like, and Burns would have just hated this analogy, but in Heller thought that he had solved the problem of recessions with tax cuts, and Ackley wanted to make the program complete by showing how you could deal with inflation by tax increases, so that between the two of them, Heller and Ackley, their legacy was going to be an activist fiscal policy of tax decreases and then tax increases that would stabilize the economy. And that's why they put the Fed under so much pressure in the 60s, because they knew Johnson hated high interest rates, and they wanted to use that as a club. They said, if you don't go along with tax increases, then Martin's going to have to raise interest rates. And unfortunately, Martin connived with them and agreed that, yeah, they would go for that strategy. Of course, ultimately, it failed for two reasons. One is they didn't get the tax increase, and the second, even if they'd gotten it, they still had to control money. But you get the feeling that Burns has that same sense of history being on his side, that he wants to, that his task is incomplete, that ultimately when history's written, his accomplishments will be recognized in 1953. But what he wants to go on and do next is to show how you're able to return the economy to full employment without inflation. But to do that, he needs this whole variety of government programs and interventions. And that plus his feeling that the country and Nixon needs leadership, and if they need him, let himself be seduced. As I said, the council thought that monetary policy was the most important instrument, and Burns thought that various sorts of fiscal interventions were at least as important as monetary policy. So the two circled around, and eventually they got, and they traded, and they each got what they wanted.
Well, you know, the monetary authorities, whoever it is, always argue that wrong things come from fiscal policy. And Treasury authorities, whoever they are, always argue that wrong things come from monetary policy. So I think Burns is not at all exceptional in this respect.
Yes, but it's more than that. I mean, the Fed chairman, he says, if you attack me, I'm going to draw attention to the deficit, and I'm going to cause you lots of problems. So you better leave me alone, because I can really, I can really.
But in fact, when the head of the Fed, whether it's Martin or Burns, testifies and tries to justify the Fed's policy, they always say that the bad things that happened were due to fiscal policy. So they don't really leave him alone.
Of course, in 1971, Burns was arguing for tax cuts when the Nixon administration was trying to.
Sure.
In reading Prosperity, I mean, I'm curious if you remember that, because Burns very clearly has a real view of inflation. He says, sure, inflation has lots of causes. One of the causes is the expansion of credit. But when he talks about the expansion of credit, he talks about the proliferation of different kinds of financial intermediaries. Mm-hmm. It's very much a Gurley Shaw, Radcliffe sort of.
I didn't remember that.
And the other thing which he emphasizes is kind of wage-price spiral. Businessmen and consumers acting
the way... Well, then he went on, because he put a great deal of emphasis on confidence in his whole business cycle analysis. Confidence of businessmen played a big part.
That must have had some influence, though. I mean, he really did believe. Well, two things on the controls. One is that in 1970, he thought he wanted to get the country moving again in a non-inflationary way, and he wanted to get businessmen invested. But the problem was, the confidence of the businessmen was eroded because the businessmen didn't know what profits they could keep because of the militant demands of labor for wage increases. And with that uncertainty about inflation and inflationary wage increases, the businessmen lacked the confidence. And at that time, he was arguing for an incomes policy, which he viewed as a kind of aggressive jawbone. Although
he always tried to pretend that he can have an income policy without official action. This is also the attitude of the Kennedy and Johnson CEO.
There's a fascinating
Tobin and Heller and so on. They also thought that you could jawbone.
There's a fascinating
Burns attacked them.
In 66, yes.
In 66, yeah.
Yeah. There's a fascinating summary of a discussion in spring of 71 about how to respond to Arthur Burns. And Nixon says, they won't teach you this in Sunday school, but jawboning, incomes policy, it's not going to do any good. Businessmen are going to follow their own self-interest. And if any businessman tells me that he's pursuing the public interest, boy, I should sell the stock in that company in a hurry. So Nixon realizes that these aren't going to have any effect.
Well, you can see that's a good example of Nixon's intellectual capacity.
Yeah, he was absolutely right. For him, it was clear you either had a controls program or you didn't. The in-between was a waste of time. And by
it's hard to understand why Arthur would have taken the position he did.
Except of all the importance he attached to government leadership and having a person who was strong and would give people confidence, the feeling that this person would lead them out of this troubled time.
Yeah, I never had
maybe he extrapolated from his own self-confidence. I mean, surely when Arthur Burns walked into a room, Arthur Burns was the center, and he may have felt that personal...
John Davenport once wrote an article for Fortune, in which he said about the Federal Reserve. He said, people ask, where is the head of the table? And he says, where Arthur sits is the head of the table.
He said that, were you the one who originally said that? Or
no.
That? Okay.
John Davenport.
Okay.
In Fortune magazine sometime.
Yeah.
I thought it was a wonderful way of describing Arthur's, the emphasis he had, the ability, the power, the confidence he generated in his own abilities.
I'm afraid I'm going to overstay my welcome. Let me ask you one more quick set of questions. Mitchell had a home in Vermont,
He
was also a cabinet maker.
Greensboro, Vermont.
I mean, you were into woodworking too, right? Weren't you?
Oh, yeah, I always have been.
Had a home.
Mitchell
so there
was
must
a
be
very complicated character. Oh, no. No, what happened was Mitchell was up in Vermont before most of the rest, and it was his being in Vermont that I think brought most of the National Bureau of people up to Vermont. See, Arthur had a home in Vermont. Jeff Moore had a home in Vermont, and so on. Most of the National Bureau people had a summer place in Vermont, and we went to Vermont thanks to Arthur.
As a political matter,
He was the one who was responsible for getting Arthur involved in the leading indicators, of course. He was asked by, was it Morgenthau? Somebody at the Treasury. Mitchell was asked. As a leading business cycle theorist in the country, he was asked if he could provide some leading indicators for the government by which some indicators of government by which they would know predict the future behavior of the economy. And he, if I remember the story, and I don't know that I have the details right, but my impression is that he had Arthur go down to Washington. And Arthur and Jeff Moore, I think, who Arthur brought down, were responsible for the original leading indicators.
And that gave a whole generation of business economists this feeling that they,
sure,
they had a knowledge of the economy.
Sure, that, they had a they tool could, that they could use.
They could play on.
Well, you were asking me one question.
Yeah, I wanted to finish this up. Just to say before I get kicked out, I want to leave gracefully.
You'll leave gracefully, don't worry.
When you read Mitchell and Birds and you read their description of the business cycle, you know, it's a dynamic theory of money illusion, but it's so complicated you can't sort it out. You don't know what shocks are, you don't know what the propagation mechanism is, you don't know what role the price system is. You get the feeling that it doesn't serve them well as an analytical apparatus, in the sense that when they take their theory to the data, when they use it to predict, if it doesn't predict, then their apparatus is so complicated that they're never going to reject their own framework. They're just going to tinker with it, because along some dimension, it's so complicated that along some dimensions it will always fit. And so the thing to do is just to play with it so that it continues to fit over time. So it's not useful as a theory in that it can't be rejected.
Well, I'm not sure that's entirely right. In the first place, they weren't taking the theory to the data, they were taking the data to the theory. And they were forming their theory out of the data.
They were looking for empirical regularities.
And Mitchell started that in his 1913 volume. He continued it to a minor extent in his 25 or 26, whatever year that was. Now, in the Burns and Mitchell volume, all of that has taken a big step forward with this much more sophisticated statistical mechanism of reference cycles, of specific cycles, of stages, and all that. But in that apparatus, they asserted certain propositions that I think it was possible to contradict with data about the length of the cycle, about the regularity of the cycle, the conformity. And some of those, unless I'm mistaken, it would have been possible to contradict. Though I agree with you that, like as in most such theories, such apparatuses, there's a lot of fitting it and go along. There's no business cycle theory, to my knowledge, has yet contradicted the simple Slutsky theory.
Which is that
the cycle is simply accumulation of random. You pick from a random number generator, a series of random numbers. Now accumulate.
Well, that's the real business cycle theory. These productivity shocks are just this.
I know that's just a series of random.
And what you feed in is what you
get out. It's just a bunch of nonsense.
Yeah.
But you see, they give it a name. They call it productivity shock.
But they don't restrict it with any kind of theory.
None whatsoever.
So they
Well, they calculate the shocks as deviations from a production function.
But those models are
they mimic the cycle, but they don't parallel it.
Well, as you said, the difference between can and do.
That's right.
But those models are like. I think this is one problem with economics today, with all its sophistication. The absolute requirement that theories have to be general equilibrium means that the models are so complicated that they will always fit along some dimensions and not along others.
Sure.
So you don't reject them, because you just take the dimensions along which they do not fit and you tinker with the model.
I agree with you on that. I'm just questioning whether the Burns-Mitchell apparatus wasn't a good deal more specific. See, the Burns-Mitchell people were not trying to mimic the cycle. They were really trying to describe it in a limited number of dimensions. In any event, I don't feel very strongly about that one way or the other.
Except that for Burns, kind of more knowledge about the business cycle always, in effect, was more detailed knowledge about particular series and how and that's a different way of proceeding than by drawing the line and saying, I have this simple framework which yields implications and there. And so what I want to ask you is that since your approach was so, correct me if I'm wrong, but when I read your, it was a 1952 article about measurement and your assertions about a good theory, the idea, or one of the ideas, is to make the theory simple enough that it can be rejected.
Absolutely.
By the data. And that's so very different than the NBER approach. Where did that come from? It didn't come from necessarily your views. It didn't necessarily come from people like Frank Knight, because they weren't empiricists.
No, it didn't come from Frank Knight at all.
And people like Hotelling were statisticians. So where did this Chicago school come from?
Well, I don't really know, because of the fact that the doctrine, the view, the methodological view, that what was important was prediction and possibility of rejection, turned out to be identical with the Popperian view. Fundamentally, it's the Popperian view of methodology. One of his famous books is labeled, or articles is labeled, Contradiction and Refutation, or Refutation and Contradiction, something like that. It doesn't matter. But at the time I wrote my first drafts of what later was a methodology essay, I had not met or read or heard of Popper. So I know that wasn't a source of influence. So where it came from, I don't know. I really can't answer that question.
Would you be willing to...
Some people later have thought maybe it came from Dewey, but I never read Dewey.
John Dewey?
Yeah.
Well,
John Dewey was a
Mitchell
instrumentalist.
Mitchell was Dewey's student.
Yeah,
Mitchell didn't have this view.
No, he didn't.
Would you be willing to talk a little bit about your relationship with the Cowles Commission?
Oh, sure.
Because your debate with them must have helped you.
I'm sure it had a great deal.
And you had some things in common with them.
Oh, sure.
About how to think in general about identification. But your strategy for actually coming up with models was very...
Okay. Oh, yeah. I don't think we weren't in agreement on the subject of identification. We were in agreement. I think what was common between us was, first, the use of mathematics.
Yeah.
Second, the use of statistics. See, that was in the early period after the war. And in 1945, when the war ended, I was at the highest point I ever reached in terms of my control, my ability in statistics.
Yeah.
Because I had just spent 2 years primarily in statistics. And it went downhill from there. But I was still, by the 50s, very much involved in purely statistical kind of thing. And they were, too, in statistical methodology. We were both interested in the use of mathematics. We were both interested in essentially the same problem of how you interpret the economy as a whole and the business cycle. And we both liked to argue. And those seminars were very good seminars. They had very able people there.
Oh, yeah.
After all, a whole collection of people were very good. So, I differed from them, I think, on the subject of identification. because I thought that nothing could ever be completely identified. It was impossible. And that's where I somehow, I know I had the idea of prediction at that time, because that's where I introduced the notion of a naive test.
But they're
of asking whether their structural model could produce better results than simply extrapolating the past.
Okay, let me put it this way. Their view toward identification was more mathematical. That is, you start with a mathematical model of the economy, a set of stochastic difference equations. You impose formal identifying restrictions from the theory, and then you take that to the data. And in fact, if you had the theory, you could do that. But the problem is you don't have the theory. And at that point, you had worked on, for example, on the Civil War and inflation,
mm-hmm.
and comparing the amount of inflation in the Civil War with other episodes. So it seems like your work led you along a different line. Your approach was to realize that the data were given by very poor experimental design, to look across historical episodes and to think, what comes closest to the controlled experiment need as scientists
to determine causality. I used to say there's no such thing as a completely controlled experiment, and there's no such thing as an entirely uncontrolled historical episode. And many a historical episode will be a better controlled experiment. You couldn't ask for a better controlled experiment than this century gave us on collectivism versus free markets.
And this is one of the discouraging things about macroeconomics now. People, when they go to study economics, they take a time series and they run it over, you know, however long they have the series. But the way to think about it is to look at the 1970s and say, you will never get as clear an experiment of policymakers trying to use nominal variables to control real variables.
Mm-hmm.
And look at what happened.
Yeah.
And then to do a time series VAR, which combines the 50, 60, 70, it makes
insane sense.
Absolutely,
I agree with you. Absolutely not. No. I've never seen any sense of these VARs. And I think this business, the real business cycle, is stuff is for the birds. It doesn't prove a thing. In fact, I was contemplating writing a little note to the Journal of Economic Perspectives, which had a long article in it. The latest issue of the JEL had a series of articles on the real business cycle theory, and some pro, some con. And I was thinking of writing a little note just saying that according to what are these two authors, who,
Prescott and somebody else, whoever it is,
they say that the
Kidlin and Prescott.
Anyway, they say that the amplitude of the real business cycle approximately 65% of the amplitude of the historical business cycle, the empirical business cycle. And this is 65, and this is 50, and this is 75, various real business cycle models. And they try to make it, they imply that that's some evidence in favor of those models. But the Slutsky equation can be constructed. What do they call it? They configure theirs. Doesn't matter, I'll get the word, it's in the article. At any rate, you can take a Slutsky model and get it to have an amplitude. You pick the right period of accumulation and the right amplitude of the random forces you put in, and get it to be 65.
Which one
shall I believe?
They can get theirs to be 110%.
Well, oh, shit, they could easily make it
110%. I mean, the problem, everybody recognizes now that the characteristics of the series that you use as input determine the characteristic for the series you get as output. And yet they impose no discipline from theory on the series they use as the input.
It's just a purely arbitrary, it just had nothing to do with anything. Just an exercise in mathematical ingenuity.
I think if you could identify the shock, it would probably be useful about.
Well, but how would you identify it?
Well, they don't talk about that. They don't have government, they don't have money. Okay.
But your question is a very good one, because I'm sure that must have had some source I didn't pick it out of the blue sky.
Let me read you.
I don't know where.
Let me read you the things that were in Koopman's article, Measurement Without Theory.
Yeah.
Because, well, he says, my first argument then is that even for the purpose of systematic and large-scale observation of such a many-sided phenomenon, theoretical preconceptions about its nature cannot be dispensed with, and the authors do so only to the detriment of their analysis. There is no sign in the book of an awareness of the problems of determining the identifiability of and measuring structural equations as a prerequisite to the practically important types of prediction. Without resort to theory, conclusions relevant to the guidance of economic policies cannot be drawn. The mere observation of regularities in the interrelations of variables, then, does not permit us to recognize or to identify behavior equations among such regularities.
Now, the problem with that quotation is that they were using a theory, but it wasn't his theory. He's right that you can't do anything with data without theoretical preconceptions, but how did they pick the particular theories they studied and the interrelations between those theories? It was from theoretical preconceptions that underlay what they did, but it was a different theory than his theory. It wasn't a general equilibrium theory.
Not clear what it was.
Not clear what it was. It was not an explicit theory.
And, a kind of feeling that over time imbalances develop because of lagged price adjustment and the size of the capital stock gets out of line.
But the kind of theory it was, go back to your original thing.
Yeah.
The kind of theory that was embedded. There was a difference between nominal variables and real variables.
Right, it's dynamic money illusion.
That's right.
That was the kind of theory that was invented. The Gibson effect sort of thing is what they were identifying. But there was no, that's useful as a propagation mechanism, but it's not, you can't do anything with it without some clear precision of what the shocks are.
I know,
but they could turn this into a theory of a self-perpetuating movement from one stage to the next, and
they thought that by identifying empirical regularities, they could specify the theory more fully.
There was a self-equivalent.
Would you like something to drink or anything? I don't know. I feel I'm not being a very good host to you.
Let me just. I think we can probably finish.
I am going to kick you out pretty soon, but I'll be glad to give you some Coke or something in between.
In just a second. But the self-equilibrating mechanism in this, it wasn't the price system.
No, it wasn't, because they were concerned with the global aggregate phenomena and not with what they thought of. Well, no, that's not right. I don't know how to answer your question on that, because they were very conscious of the effects of the price system.
Yes.
Certainly, both Arthur and Mitchell were conscious of the effect of the price system.
But the heart of the marginal analysis is the way that prices are determined by small changes, so that prices convey information about scarcity, and that's not in their work. The price system is a way of communicating information about scarcity and clearing markets. It's the psychology of the businessman that drives.
I don't know what to say about that. Arthur, for example, was a very devout Marsharian. He knew Marshall in and out, and was a very strong follower of Marshall's analytical apparatus, which surely includes what you're now talking about.
But think of the other economists of the time, like Abba Lerner, like Modigliani. Their macroeconomics was a relationship, as you explained in talking about Leon Hufud, macroeconomics was separate from microeconomics, and the price system didn't work well enough so that when you got a shock, you had quantity adjustments. And so these economists, as good as they were, weren't able to integrate their neoclassical framework with their macroeconomics.
But
so the surprise Burns
but
didn't
do. But that statement that you've made was this theory of the relation between the financial and the real. But again, that's exactly what that is. It's a money illusion. Money illusion in the sense that it can't that the real economy doesn't adjust fast enough. But, and you're right, there was no price theory in theirs. And there's a sense, see, the difference between them and this
mm-hmm.
is that Burns and Mitchell were working on what you might almost call micro units. They were working on a much more detailed basis than Oberlin or Early and Hooper. They were working on such aggregates as investment, consumption, interest mm-hmm. rates, etc. Whereas Burns and Mitchell were working on iron and steel, on aluminum, on copper. They were working on what were really micro magnitudes in one mm-hmm. sense.
Yeah.
They were macro in the sense that they were working on industry-wide mm-hmm. aggregates, not on individual firms. But surely they were aware that the price, let's say, of copper was going to depend on supply and demand.
But
and you're asking, does that in any way affect their? But they thought of business cycles as just presenting raw data.
But what they were concerned with was this dynamic evolution through time of the behavior of prices, and to that they did not have an optimizing framework that made this static mm-hmm. analysis dynamic.
No,
they took it down a dead end.
Well, I'm afraid you're right on that. If you look at Mills's behavior of prices,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't have any theory in it at all. It's the most more extreme than Mitchell and Burns. And he was a National Bureau too. He was a Mitchell. Yeah. I don't know how to answer that question.
Why don't you give me something to drink and I'll ask you one more.
Okay. What would you like to drink?
You begin both monetary history and monetary trends with epigrams about the importance of organizing facts around a theory.
Mm.
What did you mean by the quote, "What are large collections of facts for? To make theories from," says Bacon, "to try ready-made theories by," says the history of discovery. "It's all the same," says the idolater. "Nonsense," says we. Mm-hmm. What did you mean by that?
Just what it says. That you cannot make theories without some factual evidence, but you cannot use facts alone to get your theories. That neither the naive empiricist was thinking that if you just look at enough facts, they'll explain themselves. That's what, it's the same proposition. See, the other epigram, that epigram is from De Moivre, I think, isn't it?
Hey, it says Augustus De Morgan, A Budget of Paradise.
De Morgan, that's right, A Budget of Paradise. A wonderful book, if you've ever looked at it. But the other one, and the other book is from Marshall, and it says, "Facts by themselves are silent." For he who, the most misleading statement, he who says that facts speak for themselves. That's it, isn't it? The most misleading of all statements
yeah.
is facts yeah. speak for themselves
yeah.
without reference to how they're organized or who does the organizing and so on. Well, that epigram from Bacon, from De Morgan,
yeah.
encapsulates it all. Pure empirical induction will get you nowhere. But on the other hand, you can't construct or test or develop a theory without looking at without building in some empirical evidence into it. It's a two-way street. And I think that's yeah. a very good
yeah.
quotation.
Yeah. Yeah, it really makes you think about, well.
You know, yeah. the other thing I remember so well from De Morgan is that's where this little poem appears about infinity. About, what has it? Dogs have fleas on their backs to bite them, and big fleas have little fleas to incite, and so on ad infinitum. Yeah.
This has got to be the essence of the Chicago School, isn't it? They have theories simple enough that you can go back and forth from the theory to the data and work
right.
iteratively between
one
the
of
two.
These, of the old Chicago, I'm not sure it any longer is, because that's not Bob Lucas.
No, it's not Bob Lucas. Although Bob Lucas was so brilliant that in the 70s he could do both. He could take the breakdown of the Phillips curve and take your expectations augmented Phillips curve and provide an underpinning, a rational expectations underpinning that was useful for explaining why monetary policy cannot systematically control real variables. So that was his best work, where he combined the two.
But I think the later business, in which he's entirely trying to get to the general equilibrium analysis, is much less satisfactory. But I'm not running Bob down, because I think he did a tremendous service in promoting the ideas. But I agree with you. It's this notion of seeing in a way. Well, I don't know. What I was going to say, I guess, is not right. But you raised a question I wish I had an answer to, but I don't.
The question of where your own
methodology came from. And I'm trying to think about it, whether any of that could have come out of the work I was doing at the statistical research group. It seems completely unrelated in a way.
By the early 50s, when you had developed these views and you first began to use the quantity theory, you'd been away from Chicago for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
Then you came, you'd been away from Viner and Knight.
Oh, sure. There, I was left there in 1935, and I really wasn't back. I didn't get back until 1946.
These ideas must have been percolating for a long time. In the Depression, the problem was how to solve the unemployment gap, and in the 40s it was how to solve the inflation gap, and you needed a symmetric explanation.
Well, but so far as inflation was concerned, and reading some of the memos I wrote at the Treasury in the early 40s, they were strictly Keynesian. So, I don't know when it...
Those memos don't reflect a sense of the... I think this is one place that's caused some confusion about your work in money and the work that, say, that was done elsewhere on the East Coast. You applied price theory in a consistent way that others weren't doing. That is, others were working on money demand, and they were bringing marginal analysis to bear on the public's demand for money. But you were doing that plus talking about the price level within the neoclassical framework of supply and demand, where you both brought money supply and real money demand to bear. So there's a loyalty. I know what you said about economists and the disciplines out there, and everybody learns it. But there was a loyalty to the price system that was an adherence to the price system that you can only find in a few economists like Viner at the time, when he works out the price species flow mechanism, that just isn't there elsewhere. And when you took it to monetary matters, you worked it out fully in terms of the marginal analysis for the real demand for money and the interaction between nominal money demand and supply. And so it's like you and Stigler were one of the few people left in the world that really thought the price system could coordinate economic activity. And you brought that to bear on the macroeconomic level, and Stigler brought it to bear on the microeconomic level. So that must have come from, ultimately, from Chicago.
Yes, but it came, I think, but I think you mustn't underemphasize the influence of Simons and of Aaron Director. I think they both were very, very influential. Simons, of course, died in 1946.
Yeah.
Aaron is still around, but of course not very active. But, and certainly in connection with industrial organization, with George's work, Aaron was a very important stimulus. But equally in connection with the monetary side. Remember, he worked with Paul Douglas on the question of unemployment. Douglas and Director, in their book on unemployment, they really proposed a stable monetary growth policy. So that, and Aaron was always very much wedded to the price theory analysis, price analysis, very much in Viner's tradition. Knight was too.
Yeah, but Knight didn't.
But Knight wasn't interested in it.
Right, and but Simons thought it was hard to control liquidity.
And you're now talking about the monetary side.
Yeah.
But on the price side, certainly the notion of being faithful to the price analysis, to supply and demand, permeated Simons just as much on the macro side as it did on the micro side. But he thought that demand for money would be highly unstable.
When I read Viner in his book on international trade, it's like a great cathedral, just kind of the overarching view of how the price system works to equilibrate the balance of trade and establish the absolute and relative price levels between countries. It's really not only aesthetically beautiful, but it has real explanatory power. Did he talk about that price species flow mechanism in the class that you had at Chicago?
Or was it a strict price theory class? Not in 301. Not in the price theory.
So you weren't exposed to that at that time?
Oh, yes.
You were?
Oh, because he also gave a course in international trade.
And he taught his book in that trade?
No, he didn't really teach his book. He was really working at that time on what came out later as the... I really can't tell you in detail. I no longer remember in detail, but I don't think he taught the book. Mm-hmm. I'm sure the book entered in. Yeah. I'm sure we all read the book. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't what he taught. He taught a much broader course than that.
Mm-hmm. When was the first time you read Wealth of Nations?
Oh, almost surely. In 19, after I was at Chicago. Mm-hmm. But I can't tell you exactly when. Probably it was one of the books I was led to read by Viner's course. But I don't really know. I could see one if I have a date as to when I acquired my first Wealth of Nations.
Do you remember first reading The General Theory for the first time?
Yes, I'm not sure. But I think I read it shortly after it came out. In fact, I do have my copy of The General Theory, and I think I have in it the date on which I bought it.
On a different subject, do you have